Welcome to Democracy in Color with Steve Phillips, a color-conscious podcast about politics. I'm Charlene Chang, the co-host of this podcast, and a year and a half ago, I was introducing Steve as a guest on his own show for the first time, and may I say, it's great to have him back on as our guest. The second edition of Steve's book, a national best-selling book, might I add, How We Win the Civil War, which is a fully updated paperback edition, comes out next Tuesday, March 12th. So everyone mark your calendars. And quick favor to ask for all of you listening. A, if you have not read the book yet, please consider getting a copy. If you have a copy of the first edition, please consider getting a copy for someone you know. And C, if you've read the book and love it, please consider leaving a review on Amazon or Goodreads, because if you're like me, I just check out Amazon and Goodreads first sometimes before I buy a book. So reviews really matter. Steve is getting ready to go on a national tour to talk about his book and this year's elections. So tune in to stevephillips.com because we will be updating his events and he may be near your somewhere where you live and you can go meet him and talk to him about his book. Next week, just 2 days after this second edition is released, he'll be having a webinar conversation with Showing Up for Racial Justice's Executive Director, Erin Haney. And for those of you who listen regularly, you might recognize her name. She was a former guest on our podcast recently, and we're going to link to that upcoming event, which is going to be an online event, webinar. And we will also link to the episode so you can hear the conversation with Erin and Steve again, and we'll put all those in the show notes. So here we are. This is a pretty big week when we are recording this. We've been working our way through the primaries, Super Tuesday, including this week. And now, you know, we know it's going to be Biden versus Trump for sure, for sure. And now we can really just move ahead in terms of how we are looking at this election season. There are also several major developments, and we're going to touch upon them a little bit today. And without further ado, I want to welcome our guest, our special guest. Hi, Steve. I'm so thrilled to have you on today.
Hi, Charlene. Thanks for having me on. It's an honor to be on the podcast. Democracy in Color is one of my favorite podcasts, and I'm just delighted to be with you guys.
Thank you. Well, we rely on listeners like you to do what we do, and we do it for you. So I just want to jump into and say I kind of can't believe it's been 2 years since the hardcover of How We Win the Civil War first came out, and we did do an episode where you and I chatted about that when that first launched, and we'll put a link to that episode in our show notes. And I wanted to set the scene a little bit about when the first edition came out. So it was Time Machine, rewind. It was October 18th, 2022. That was the launch date for the first edition. And we were just a few weeks away from what would become a historic midterm election. Stacey Abrams was on the ballot. It seems like so much longer ago in some ways, but she was on the ballot, and she was on the ballot to become the first Black woman governor of Georgia. Thinking back, what do you feel has changed in the political landscape since the first edition of How We Win the Civil War came out? And why is this book even more relevant now than it was in 2022?
Well, a lot of things have actually changed, and then a lot of things have not. And so, mm-hmm. You know, you're talking about Stacey. The most pertinent point to understand Stacey's election, which we do talk about in the preface to the book, is that the United States of America has still never elected a Black woman as governor of any state. Mm-hmm. And that really boiled down to its essence is gives you what you need to know about why Stacey Abrams is not currently a governor. So you have that reality. And we talk about that in the preface, trying to give some analysis of what happened and what didn't happen. I think for that, it really is critical to understand and appreciate, despite the disappointment about Stacey not being the governor, is that Raphael Warnock, the literal successor to Martin Luther King at Ebenezer Baptist Church, is in fact United States Senator. And we talk in the Georgia chapter in the book about how the runoff primary system was created by a Georgia state legislator really to prevent the kind of thing that happened with Warnock, where you have many white candidates splitting the white vote, consolidated vote behind a Black candidate who comes in first but doesn't get 50%. So then they created runoff. So I give the context and the history for that going back to the 60s. As the guy, Denmark Groover, was Georgia state legislator, who was also the person who did the legislation to embed the Confederate flag in the Georgia state flag. So that context is all in there. And so I just say that to say that I think we skip over the significance of Raphael Warnock winning these multiple elections, winning despite runoff primaries, to the extent that they're now talking about getting rid of runoff primaries. Like, well, it's like, well, that didn't work.
Didn't work. So move let's on try to see what else can work, right?
Right. So I just want to say that about Georgia. And we talk about Georgia in the revised edition and talk about the 2022, trying to give some analysis and framework to that. So there's that. And then beyond that, most consequentially is that we are, we're in the middle of a presidential election, but B, we are in a presidential election that is almost quite literally existential in terms of this country, in terms of what kind of nation are we going to be? Are we going to be a multiracial democracy, or are we going to be a nation who's really dedicated to making America white again? And that is very much what is in front of us. And people have talked about, and I don't think there's enough appreciation of seeing the warning signs even in front of our face, that it's not inconceivable this could be the last presidential election we have if it goes the wrong way. And we could easily see that other person refusing to hold an election. And then people would just go along with him and say, well, we'll just continue. That's how dictatorships begin.
Right.
It's not like there's a whole, you know, they're not as dramatic in their beginnings as we may think in terms of these things can't happen here. So these stakes are enormous. And that's why I'm really glad that we can have the book come out now, right at the beginning of the presidential election in terms of the general election contest, and to really be able to frame up what is before us and to really help to interpret and give some guidance and frankly some reassurance to people on how to understand what's actually happening and how to navigate it in terms of being most impactful, and also just kind of how to steel ourselves to a certain degree, because all these different things happen and there's like so many outrageous things happening that if we react to each of them, it's going to drive us crazy. But if we step back and have the analysis and the understanding that the Confederates have quite literally never stopped fighting the Civil War, they are at war with us. And so we should not be surprised at all of these different things that get proposed or that happens. We can frame that up and not be as distressed at each of these individual things, and then also help to focus in on what is necessary to win, which is the whole second half of the book, is how do we win? And so can we draw upon and apply those lessons in 2024? And then the other thing I think we do also have to start thinking about, which I think can also give people more hope and inspiration, is to, it's tied to this first point about how the Confederates and their descendants have shredded the social contract. They have no regard for the institutions, the democratic institutions in this country. And so we can and should be some level dismayed by that. At the same time, we should be clear-eyed and optimistic. So then we do not need to adhere to trying to get those people to agree on a social contract. Let's write a new one that reflects who we really are and what we really believe. So those are some of the themes that I'm trying to put out into the world. That's why I am out on the road. I'm in my fourth or fifth city in 8 days, I believe, at the moment. Shout out Houston, and where it's 89 degrees. But we're trying to get around to share this message to try to help rally people as much as possible to respond to this moment that I do believe is quite literally existential for this country.
Absolutely. And I know I always bring this up because I just think it's a great story and just another example of how prescient you often are, especially with your book titles. But I love to tell this story about when you were first approached by your publisher, New Press. They said, "Hey, Steve, you know, your first book, Brown is the New White, became a New York Times bestseller, a Washington Post bestseller. It did really well and really generated terrific national conversations." So they were asking you, what do you have in mind? What are some things that you're mulling over and would like to say and interject into the national conversation around politics? And this was how many years ago when they first?
It was April of 2020.
Oh, 2020. For just sort of like picking your brain if you had another idea for a book. April 2020. And you said, you know, I have this framing. I'd like to say something to the effect of how what I'm seeing is that this country is politically in the continuation of the Civil War, that the Civil War never ended. And the publisher at first kind of was just taken aback and had some response like, well, you know, isn't that, that feels a little bit overdramatic. Civil War, I mean, that's a very charged way to talk about what's happening now. I mean, we're not really in a civil war. And I just wanted to take us back to that moment and reflect, because as we've seen, people are understanding that that is not, in fact, hyperbolic.
Absolutely. And then we didn't originally mean it quite as literally as it's come to be applied, in that just looking at the level of division and the validation of white nationalism within the country, it made sense to think about the word civil war, to kind of contextualize and frame up and kind of get people's attention. In many ways, kind of meant it as a metaphor. So this was April of 2020. What is it, 8 months later? People carrying the Confederate flag, wearing sweatshirts saying MAGA Civil War, January 6, 2021, stormed the United States Capitol, tried to kill the Vice President of the United States, and tried to stop the peaceful transfer of power in a bloody and violent confrontation, an attack on the Capitol, unlike anything we've ever seen before. And I was like, well, this is not metaphorical at all anymore. And so that really gave some, you know, clarity and focus. And then the more we did the research and the more we started writing the book, it was like, oh, it's actually quite literally true. There's an organization, United Daughters of the Confederacy, and their companion group, Sons of Confederate Veterans, who are the genealogical heirs of Confederate soldiers. UDC, United Daughters of the Confederacy, has 700 chapters across the country. It's a multi-million dollar organization rooted and based in Virginia that continues to do this. They have this catechism. They have this children of the Confederacy grouping that indoctrinates young people in the Confederate mindset. Sons of Confederate Veterans has a website that continues to sell Confederate and Civil War memorabilia of white nationalist murderers and white nationalist slave owners and slave traders. They were selling Nathan Bedford Forrest's soap, and he was one of the early leaders of the Ku Klux Klan. Over, was a general in Civil War, known for the level of brutality and violence and carnage that he caused. And this is who they celebrate. And this is today. You can go to their website right now and actually see these types of things. So you take that all the way up to the previous president continuing to defend people like Robert E. Lee and other Confederate leaders. And so that person's moving that forward. And then the vast majority of the Republican Party supporting this person. So this is the moment that we're in. And so the phraseology that started out more symbolic to a certain extent is actually quite substantive, but ultimately I feel quite informative and in an odd way kind of empowering, because it disabuses us of the notion that these people subscribe to the same social contract and the same institutions and are trying to work within the bounds of society. Once we're liberated or disabused of that notion, then I think it can, was it Bob Marley, emancipate yourself from mental slavery, right? That then lots more become possible in terms of smarter and better and more effective action.
So Steve, some people might be wondering more about the second edition. And let me first just here on camera showing the cover. It's really beautiful. It's similar to the hardcover version, but one of the main differences is it has this nice sort of circular medallion that says national bestseller, and it's got a little blurb on the front cover, a seminal and urgent work by Senator Cory Booker, and it says revised and updated with a new preface. And so can you tell us a little bit about, you know, I mean, I just did kind of give a little of the preview, what does make it different, but in terms of, you know, revised and updated and the preface, just tell us a little bit about what people can expect a little differently from the second edition.
So two things. One is it's completely updated. And so the first book was, and we were pushing to get it out before the midterms, because that was really a critical time period as well. And we wanted to be able to give some guidance and understanding around the midterm elections. And I do believe that our fundamental analysis held, because there was this conventional wisdom that it's going to be this red wave and the Democrats were doomed and we were moving in this direction. And we were trying to lay out, and that's not at all the case. The numbers don't show that. The underlying math, a lot of the math that we talked about in Brown is in White, doesn't show that. And that if we do the things that we talked about in how we win the Civil War, focus on voter mobilization, investing in strong civic engagement groups, we should actually be able to hold the House of Representatives. And certainly held back any red wave. What was the phrase? It was like a pink puddle, and alternatively. But we really shouldn't even have lost the House. It was really the poor organization in by Democrats in New York and California that surrendered the seats that would have held the House. So I say all that to say is that the first book was focused on the midterms. And then this one sums up the lessons of the midterms. And so we look at both in the preface and then throughout the book, talk about in reference, and it's updated to take into account what happened in the midterms and what the key lessons of that were. And then is more focused on the 2024 general election and the years beyond, but particularly coming out right now in ways that we're trying to modernize it to make it as timely and on point as possible. So I think say that broadly. And then in addition, I also try to provide a framework and an analysis, and I draw from the conversation that Isabel Wilkerson had with Taylor Branch. And those are both two very, incredible writers. Taylor Branch, you know, historian, and they're people who are very formative in terms of my own writing and my own approach. And actually it was Taylor Branch almost 30 years ago when he wrote Parting the Waters, America in the King Years, illuminated a path for me about how to write and put things in historical context and draw even like the popular culture references that talk about what's happening. So I learned a lot from him then and always loved those books. And then I think I've talked before about how Isabel Wilkerson in general and her book Cast in particular was very much my muse and how much she utilized stories, right? So, you know, my late wife Susan had talked about the importance of stories in books to be able to make them accessible and understandable to people. And so I drew from her. And so in Cast, she recounts a conversation that she had with Taylor Branch. And this was in 2018, after a lot of the incidents of domestic terrorism, particularly the Tree of Life synagogue shooting in 2018, and there were a number of other 2018 incidents. The conversation, Taylor Branch asked Wilkerson, where do you think we are now? Do you think that this is 1950s in terms of the equivalent period that we're grappling with and where we're facing? And Wilkerson says, I think it's 1880s. And they have this conversation about, is that too bleak, et cetera, et cetera. Different things have changed. So I take that framework and that conversation, and it caused me to reflect. And then the essence of the preface is I try to frame this moment. And I say, I think we're actually in 1876, which was the period after Reconstruction, where we had some sustained effort towards making America a multiracial democracy. Are we going to continue down that road, or are we going to go back to a period when this was fundamentally a white country? That's what was at stake in 1876. I believe that's what's at stake now. So in the preface, I try to talk about that and illuminate that and articulate that framework and that analysis to give us guidance around how to look at 2024 and then what to do in 2024 in order to prevent what happened in 1876, where they did hand the country back to the slave owners.
I love that particular citing, when you cite that exchange between the two of them. You had said, you know, I'm just kind of read a little bit from the book. Branch thought Wilkerson was being awfully bleak in her referencing 1880s. Black people were subject to total exclusion from political life. People were being lynched openly. Wilkerson wrote that she fervently hoped to be wrong. So that's part of the preface, right? And you just open right with these two intellectuals, writers, Black writers and intellectuals, hashing out, where are we now?
That point as well, that in that, they kind of end that conversation with, which I had used in the first edition as well in the intro, but to frame that up, is that Branch says to her, I guess the question is, if given a choice between democracy and whiteness, how many people would choose whiteness? And then Wilkerson ends that chapter saying, we let that hang in the air, neither of us willing to hazard a guess as to that one.
Yeah, that was, I love that quote. And it's chill. It's like sends chills down my spine, but it's just so powerful and so meaningful. And that question, That's the question. And that is perfect segue into, I did wanted to share just an excerpt from the book. I was thinking about, oh, I'm going to try to pick my favorite excerpt, and there's just too many. You did such a great job, like you said, curating stories throughout history, and also with the different case studies of leaders in the progressive movement now, their personal stories and the stories of how different wins were won in the progressive movement over the past 5 to 10 years. But I had to pick one of them. So I thought this is one that comes from the intro. I like just how you set it up, and it's just so compelling. This, again, it's not new. It's from the intro, but I wanted to read it out loud. You were painting a scene. So I'm going to share it for listeners. For context, this is a scene where you introduce, there's this woman, Linda, and her son, Eric. They drove 10 hours from Tennessee to D.C. to the nation's capital on January 6th, 2021. And you write, as Lisa put it, quote, the left has everything, the media, organizations, the government. We have to organize if we're going to fight back and be heard. Lisa also shared that a violent revolution has been on the cards thanks to last year's racial justice protests, anti-police riots, and unnecessary coronavirus lockdowns. With tears in her eyes, and apparently while eating a hot dog, Lisa defiantly declared, I'd rather die as a 57-year-old woman than live under oppression. I'd rather die and would rather fight. Like mother, like son, Eric extended the military metaphor, saying, we wanted to show that we're willing to rise up, band together, and fight if necessary. So that was just one of the beginning scenes of your intro. And it's just one of my favorite, not because it's not terrifying, but it's just you did such a good job connecting us with these individuals and painting that scene. And kind of when I was reading this, even in the drafts, it just put me right there with this woman and her son. They drove all this way, and there she is. They're all to feel really in their hearts a sense of conviction that they're doing the right thing. And she's being interviewed and eating a hot dog, and it just says so much.
Yeah, well, I think that part of, I thought it was, you know, I tried to dramatize January 6th, but also to show how almost like the, I mean, it's almost a little too dramatic to say, but not the banality of evil, in that, or the normalcy of it.
The normalcy.
And so you have this mother and
normal people, regular people.
Right.
Yeah.
It's not like there's some other separate thing or these unusual, this would never happen here. These normal people, a mother and their son, making excursion to Washington, D.C., which lots of people do with their families. And yet they're up there, and she's egging people on to attack the United States government. And she's, you know, applauding and encouraging people to try to literally attack the elected government of this country. But it's just these normal people, right? And so I thought they wanted to be able to really kind of illustrate that and drive that home, is I don't think that we really appreciate that, right? So somewhat, in a somewhat similar vein, this isn't as much in the book, but I think the point is the same, that last January, we went to Virginia and we spent time with the folks who are featured in the book in Virginia, Tram Nguyen and Maya Castillo Morrison and others. And they took us to the library in Richmond, Virginia, where they have the actual records, originals and original newspapers from the period of the Civil War. And they had the ledgers. They had the handwritten ledgers from slave auctions. And it was just really struck me was just how normal and commonplace it was. You list the person's name, description of them, then it's what their position was, et cetera. And it's just somebody's job to write this down and put it into a book, and then you sell this human being to another human being. And that was the normal thing that we were doing. And so I just want to make sure that we don't lose sight of that in this current moment as well.
Well, I just really felt that moment of you seeing those ledgers in person. I've seen them online, and it always does make you know, feel quite emotional, and certainly feelings come up, but I think it's a whole other thing to see them in person too. Thanks for sharing that. Wow. So since the first edition came out, and like I said, we received a lot of positive response, not just from the media, but from readers all over the country, organizational leaders, but also normal people, everyday people. Lots of people seem to really resonate with it and felt thankful that someone was calling it, like naming it, and but also that it is hopeful, that you do lay out a bit of a blueprint, I mean, a significant blueprint in using real case studies on illustrating how those who want to see a multiracial democracy become a reality and believe that that's what America should be, that you lay out, this is how wins have been won, and this is how we can continue to learn from them so we can continue forward. So this book also resulted in some really exciting partnerships, and a lot has come to fruition through those partnerships, different organizations and those entities who want to partner to, because they were inspired and wanted to take action together. Just talking about all the those who resonated with the first edition, we got great reviews on Amazon. I wanted to read just one review by a woman named Catherine. She wrote, "As a white woman on a journey to recognize and repair the harms of colonization and white supremacy, I found myself feeling incredibly optimistic about the possibility of true democracy, justice, and equity in my lifetime. This confidence rests in the leadership of the women and organizations Phillips highlights in this book, many of whom America does not yet know, but should. If you're looking for a real talk education along the lines of Isabel Wilkerson's cast, alongside outstanding storytelling, pick this up now and don't put it down until you've figured out what you will do to help end the Civil War for good." I just love that. And Catherine, if you're listening, I don't know who, you know, but this is, we appreciate you. And that just gives listeners a little example. You don't have to write something even quite that long, but it's just nice to have that kind of review out there for others to get a sense of what they got out of the book. So Steve, what have been some of the biggest highlights for you since the book was released, the first edition was released?
Yeah, well, it's been very gratifying is that you spend 2 years, a lot of people spend even more time typing on a keyboard, looking at a blank screen, and then, but then trying to think about how do you tell a story, illuminate a point, make an argument, lift up, and how to do this in as, you know, effective and powerful way as possible. And, you know, in a lot of ways, the only real audience for it, and I have a lot of ways, in most ways, was you, right? So I would do these chapters and send them to you, and then you would send back edit, and is it tight enough, and is it, you know, getting it sharper and sharper? But you don't know how it's going to land in the real world. And so it's just, it's kind of an odd exercise that you're really looking, it's almost like out into space in some ways, but you have no idea, there aren't really actual real humans as you're doing the exercise of writing the book. So since it's come out, I've been able to meet these people, and it's been really very rewarding and exciting to find people for whom it landed the way we had hoped. And we had really tried to provide information and inspiration around what we could really do. And so, you know, for instance, Laura Rotello is the field director of ACLU Massachusetts. And so they had me out for an event in Boston, and Laura has a copy of the book that has like 20 or 30 different of those little, you know, flag marker thingies on different pages and whatnot.
Really, it's like color coded, like little post-it, mini post-its, almost like.
Yes. Yeah. And so she has like totally like taken it almost like as a textbook. And so it was just so rewarding to see somebody who's in the trenches doing the work, really trying to implement these types of pieces, appreciating the lessons learned and the content of it. So that was really exciting. I've reconnected with a childhood friend of mine, Dana Buell, who I went to high school with. Actually, I went to elementary school with her, which I didn't even know until a couple of weeks ago. She had me back up to Portland. But she's the social justice director of the First Presbyterian Church of the Unitarian Universalist, and has really gotten us connected into that whole community of the Unitarian Universalist. We did an event with the Unitarian Universalist social justice grouping online. I think it's the largest event we've done. It's like 450 people or something were part of it and whatnot. And there's other folks in Texas and Florida from that network that want to be connected to it. And like I was just up there, I on this, you know, tour and trip now, I was in Portland last week. And it was really just very moving to present and speak to people, just to feel the response and how much they appreciated, not frankly, how much, how inspired they were. So that was really exciting. The woman, Finale Norton in Virginia of Network Nova, I'm actually going to be on doing an online thing with them on Friday, the day after this comes out, who's just really, again, embraced it. And I had wanted to, there's a little bit what we felt when we did Brown is the New White. I remember there was a minister in Louisiana who called me up and said, we've been saying these things and trying to make this argument, and people haven't believed us, and we didn't have the evidence, and now we have your book. And so I really wanted to try to provide a tool and an empowerment tool in that direction. And then the other group I just want to lift up is really Surge showing up for racial justice. And it's been a great partnership and connection with them around trying to find a group who acknowledges that we need to summon white people to be explicitly courageous and connected to the movement for racial justice, and to work with them and to put that work in the context of building a multiracial coalition. So we're developing a pretty deep partnership with Surge around the rollout. Aaron Haney and I are going to do this online events next week, and do a Instagram piece, and then we're going to do a webinar, and then we're going to do some in-person pieces at Surge chapters as well. So it's really been just tremendously rewarding, from having put so much time, energy, and effort and pouring yourself into it, to see the real human beings and then the real networks that are really appreciating the work that we're doing.
Yeah, I always get just so like tickled and moved when you are out there and we're hearing this respond, because it's kind of like the baby is out there. For those of who don't know, like Steve and I first met when he was embarking on the journey of writing his first book, Brown's the New White, and was looking for a book coach and editor. And I'm an editor and journalist by background. And so this was the second project that Steve was working on. And I had the privilege and honor to help him again for the first edition. And I just love to hear all the stories about all the ripple effects, because you did work so hard on it. And I put you through the torture of many, many red line edits and working on draft after draft.
I didn't know Microsoft Word counted edits until I got one of your chapters back, and there were 300 different edits and changes. So that was like,
I think I almost crashed it. It was like running out of spaces.
I do feel that it was. We joke about that, but I think that you really did help to tighten it and make it sharper. And so I do want to unjokingly thank you and appreciate you for that work.
Oh, thank you. Well, I always really enjoyed so much, and it's your voice is so important, and I really appreciate working with you and seeing your trajectory as a writer. And also, I really enjoy the editing process. And I have to say, so here I am holding up the book again. And there was a point where, you know, when it's in a Google Doc and it's, you haven't printed out yet, or even, in the beginning stages, it's hard to know how many pages you're going to end up with. And I remember at one point, you said, well, you know, I hope I have enough for something that feels like a substantial and long enough book. So I'm holding it up and flipping the paperback, and you can just see it's definitely a nice, meaty, thick book. Having said that, I've heard from so many people and through Amazon reviews that it's highly readable. I think it's highly readable. I'm obviously perhaps biased and too close, but there are people on Amazon reviewers who I don't know, who it's amazing how many times they do compare reading the book to how they felt reading Cast. And again, these are people we don't know. So that's, you know, such an honor. But also how many of them said they love the storytelling, your voice, and how highly readable it is for a political book, a political nonfiction book. So I wanted to talk about another one of my favorite parts about How We Win, is that you had mentioned her briefly earlier, is when you depicted the story of New Virginia Majority's co-executive director, Tram Nguyen, and her family's incredible backstory as refugees from Vietnam, and how her father escaped from prison to eventually join the rest of her family. And she, when she was growing up, was one of the few Asian American young people in her community. She might have probably been one of the few people of color she was one of the few Asian Americans growing up in her community. She went on to transform Virginia politically and turn it purple and definitely secure winsome wins. She also became a trusted advisor of sorts to many other political leaders and thought leaders, like including Stacey Abrams. Do you have a favorite part of the book, or what are some, you know, one that comes to mind?
Well, it's interesting. I don't, let me say a couple of things. Andrea Guerrero, who's featured in the San Diego chapter, she asked me when we were talking about the rollout what was I most excited about the book? And I paused to think about that. And I said, you know what? My whole life, certainly my whole adult life in politics, the response that we've gotten from people has always been, yeah, that people of color stuff is nice, but we have to win. So that has to take a back seat, or that has to be downplayed or de-emphasized. And I was like, no, wait, we're winning. We've won in San Diego, Harris County, Georgia, Arizona, Virginia. That's winning. So we need to look at how we won and then apply those lessons. And so that was super important and inspiring to me. And then a specific story that I think that I came across that I do like to tell a lot when I'm out on the road really was to, we talk about the Liberation Battle Plan as the core elements of how people have actually succeeded in flipping all those places that have gone through transformation. And one of those is a detailed data-driven plan. Mm-hmm. It was actually funny because I was in Massachusetts and I was recounting the elements of the Liberation Battle Plan, and I like paused for a moment, and then people were yelling out from the audience, detailed data-driven plan, right? So they had to totally internalized it. Is that, again, trying to tell the story to illuminate it. And it was learning about and applying the lessons from Montgomery bus boycott. That's right. The narrative is Rosa Parks was tired. She didn't want to give up her seat. And she got arrested. And then there was a boycott. And then we ended segregation on the buses. And it's all a very quick and simplistic thing, saying nothing of the fact that they had to boycott the buses for over 350 days. In terms of moving that whole piece forward. But there's a story in there from Joanne Robinson and the Black Women's Organization in Montgomery about the mechanics and the data-driven mechanics of how they organized the boycott. So what I like to say when I'm talking to people is, imagine trying to organize a carpool of 15 people. So you can't go in one car. So you've got to start thinking, you know, multiple cars and who's going to go in which car and where are people going to meet, et cetera. And then I was like, imagine you're trying to organize a carpool for your whole block or your whole like a building or whatnot. So a few hundred people. How many cars do you need? Where do you meet? What are the logistics of all of that? The Montgomery bus boycott was 40,000 people. And so Joanne Robinson talks about how they took 15,000 reams of paper, cut them into thirds, copied them off with the information on the boycott, fanned out across town to hand out those third sheets of paper around the bus boycott. And that's how they got the word out. The level of precision and data expertise is phenomenal, because we tend to think of data experts, frankly, as white guys and white guys with computers and whatnot. But these Black women in Montgomery, Alabama were data savants. Mm. And so that's one of the favorite stories that I love to share to illuminate the level of expertise and talent that was required to make change, but that we frequently underappreciate and don't appreciate.
I love that story. Thanks for reminding me. How long did the boycott last again?
It was over a year. So it's every single day. That's for 360 some days.
So mind blowing. And as I often say to my daughter, this was before they had cell phones. I mean, exactly. Some of those people probably didn't even have a landline.
Yep.
No social media, no email, no Google Doc. The thought of how they coordinate that for so long without those forms of technology, you'd be hard pressed to organize for that long with the technology we have today. That is, that's just a testament to, the ingenuity and the commitment and the power of organizing with people. And you don't need to have all the technology, you just need to have the plan, like you said, the detailed plan, and then the will. What's one thing that you hope people will take away from how we win as we head into this election? I mean, we're in the election season, but as we near election day.
Well, there's probably one to three things, but the one most important thing is that we can and should win. And I think that's critical for people. There's I'm in like my fifth city in like, 8 days or whatnot. And the sense of pessimism and panic and fear and concern is very pervasive out there. And it's unfounded, and it's not empirically supported by the data, right? So I wrote more recently wrote a column for The Nation trying to lay out some of these particular pieces. But more broadly, this is what the argument we make within the book, that we can and should win. And so I want people to have that level of confidence and optimism and not feeling like everything is doom and gloom, et cetera. So that's like, I think, a core piece that is kind of sustain us on a day-to-day level. And then the second part is we know how to win. And so hopefully that the lessons in the book, the Liberation Battle Plan, can help to focus our time, energy, and effort. People say, what can I do? What can I do as an individual, et cetera? You can find a level five leader like we talk about in the book. You can find a civic engagement organization that's doing voter mobilization work and get behind them. Groups like Lucha in Arizona and America Votes Georgia in Georgia. Get behind those groups and talk them up as well as move resources to them. We have proven that we know how to actually win. That's what I've tried to document in the book. And if we follow those lessons and enthusiastically lean into that, we really can and should win.
And those are great reminders. And the organizations are all listed in the book. And when Steve was saying, when you were saying, like, get behind them, you know, one of the things that does help is cash, right? Is donations. And even small donations add up. In fact, small donors are, you know, there's plenty of evidence are one of the most powerful mechanisms is the accumulation of small donors in powering the movement. So those who are looking for something to a way, rather simple and accessible way to make a difference this election year, think about supporting with some small donations even to those organizations listed in How We Win the Civil War, and then read the rest of the book for, you know, some other ideas. I just wanted to thank you so much, Steve. You know, we, as you like to say, we could be here talking all day. I mean, you and I could be here talking all day, but you're busy and you're on the road. And
yeah, well, thank you for the time. Because I say there's always so much coming at us, and every day we're trying to do something and respond to another piece and get something actually done. So we don't actually get a chance to like stop and step back and reflect and share. And so I really appreciate the opportunity to have this kind of conversation, and hope the listeners do too.
Yeah, me too. It's important to stop and celebrate, folks, as give ourselves the flowers. Again, mark your calendars. Tuesday, March 12th, the second edition comes out. Whether you've never read it before or you've read it already, please do consider getting a copy. And then please do consider leaving reviews and get it, you know, support your local bookstore or whatever online bookstore you want to buy it from. And leave a review to let us know what you thought about it. And with that, that is all the time we have for today. Thank you for listening to Democracy in Color with Steve Phillips. Please help us get the word out about this podcast by subscribing wherever you get your podcasts, sharing with your friends, tweeting at Democracy Color and at Steve P. Tweets, and finding us at Democracy in Color on Facebook or Instagram. You can also keep up with all things Democracy in Color by subscribing to our newsletter at democracyincolor.com. If you listen to our podcast on iTunes, please consider taking a few moments to leave us a rating and comment. It helps others to find our show. This podcast is a Democracy in Color production. Our producer is Olivia Parker. Fola Onifade is our staff writer and associate producer. I'm Charlene Chang. I'm editor and co-host. And special thanks to April Elkier for Quality Check, recorded virtually with the assistance of the podcast studio of San Francisco. Until next time, check out the second edition of How We Win the Civil War. Don't forget to vote and shine your light, and we will see you next time.